This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. In 1837, a city was founded at the end of the Atlantic and Western Railroad line. This was first named Marthasville, in honor of the then governor's daughter. It was nicknamed Terminus because it was the end of the line. Then officially, the name was changed to what it is today, the city of Atlanta. Flash forward more than a century, and you start to get professional sports teams in the city, with the Atlanta Falcons joining the NFL in 1965. That's where this week's guest comes in. Clayton Truder stops by to talk about his forthcoming book, titled Loserville.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott.
This time as we step off the DeLorean, the date is June 30th, 1965, and we're in Hotlanta, Georgia. We're at the celebration party of Rankin M. Smith, a successful life insurance executive. Who? At 41 years of age, was awarded the NFL's 15th franchise, ultimately becoming the Atlanta Falcons. That's where we bring in this week's guest, Clayton Truder. Clayton holds a PhD in U.S. history from Boston College and teaches at Norwich University in Northfield, Vermont. And if that name sounds familiar, well, that's because if you're a longtime listener of the show, you heard him way back, more than 2 years ago. I mean, I had to scroll through my podcast app to try to figure out when he was, and let's just say Clayton was the third guest of the Football History Dude podcast, where we talked about his favorite books about football history. Then, circle back to going on 2.5 years later, we bring Clayton back on the show to talk about another book. But this time, it's about his upcoming book, Loserville, which is going to release in February of 2022. Now, Loserville is the headline title of the book, but the tagline states how professional sports remade Atlanta and how Atlanta remade professional sports. And we get into that statement in the interview, focusing more on the Atlanta Falcons side because this is a football history show. But Clayton is going to be on multiple shows on the Sports History Network, so go ahead and check out the Sports History Network podcast so you can go ahead and learn more about the book from even a different perspective. That's at sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. But before we get into the interview, got to give a little bit of love to this week's sponsor, Row One.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, and so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings your sports history to life anywhere. The Row One gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One shop, check out the thousands more of unique items with a retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW number one, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items. Plus get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes.
Big thank you again to Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch for putting that promo spot together for us. If you like this show, then I tell you what, I guarantee, that's the guarantee, you know, the whole Joe Namath guarantee, you're going to love his show as well. It's a daily podcast covering the rich history of the gridiron. So head over there, the Pigskin Dispatch, and check it out right now. But one last thing before we go hop into this DeLorean and head back to the mid-60s of the city of Atlanta with Clayton. Row One is a mainstay sponsor with us, and something cool that Ray and his crew is doing for the listeners of the Sports History Network is giving away one t-shirt each and every week. There's also a running contest going on through the end of the year, so no matter when you listen to this episode in 2021, there's going to be an active contest for you. Or a giveaway, that is. So head over there and enter for your chance to win right now. I mean, pro tip, if you don't win this week, you keep coming back and signing up the following week because there's a good chance they got a shot to win a t-shirt from Row One Brand. You can get to this giveaway in the same way you get to the sponsor page. That's right at sportshistorynetwork.com/Row One. The letters R-O-W and the number one. sportshistorynetwork.com/Row One. With that, let's go ahead and get into this interview about Loserville with Clayton Truder.
Okay, well, that's a perfect transition into one of the questions I was going to ask, and we'll start it right there. So you have a PhD in U.S. history from Boston College, and you're a professor at Norwich University up in Vermont. How does the story of Atlanta and you wanting to write a book about something called Loserville tie into this whole thing?
Well, I mean, it begins as a product of my doctoral dissertation. When I was in graduate school, my areas of expertise and study were the history of American cities after World War II, and also the study of American culture. And professional sports is certainly a prominent part of American culture, and it played a prominent role in shaping American cities after World War II. Initially, my idea for the project was to write about the history of franchise relocations and league expansions on American cities, but my advisor suggested that was just a little bit too much to bite off. She suggested I pick a particular city that was greatly impacted by league expansions and relocations and make that the focus of my project. So that's how I came around to Atlanta. I had no particular connection to Atlanta whatsoever, but 10 years later, I've certainly spent a lot of time sitting around thinking about and reading about and talking to people about Atlanta since then.
Yeah, so you said it's kind of like a 10 years in the making, even though not necessarily specifically this book. Let's get into the title of the book. So the full title is Loserville, How Professional Sports Remade Atlanta and How Atlanta Remade Professional Sports. Why the title Loserville?
Loserville is a term that came from a sports writer and later editor of the Atlanta Constitution named Louis Grizzard. Louis Grizzard in later years became a very well-known humorist in the South, sort of a Mark Twain type humorist, almost like a Garrison Keillor for the South a little bit too. And when he was editor of the Atlanta Constitution in July 1975, he ran a two-part front page series called Loserville, which essentially detailed the failings of Atlanta's pro sports teams in the decades since Atlanta got into professional sports. In the late 60s, Atlanta gets the Braves in Major League Baseball, the Falcons in the National Football League, the Hawks in the NBA, and the Flames in the NHL, all in rapid succession. This proves to not work out quite as people anticipated. The teams are all struggling on the field. They're struggling at the box office. And Grizzard's piece was essentially lampooning the lack of success Atlanta had had after all these grand visions for how pro sports were going to be this source of pride for the community. So my title is not so much a commentary on Atlanta now. I mean, obviously the Braves were very successful in the 90s and the 2000s. The Falcons played very well for three quarters in a Super Bowl. And the Hawks, you know, are on the cusp of being an NBA championship caliber team now. So it's not like Atlanta's teams have always been bad. But this essentially is a story of the first decade of pro sports in Atlanta in the 60s and 70s. In terms of the subtitle refers to essentially how Atlanta invented the business model that cities now use if they want to become a major league city. Atlanta went out, they offered big subsidies to build a stadium and an arena to lure pro sports to their community. Very quickly, this helped Atlanta bring in four pro sports teams in a matter of 6 years. Other cities saw this and emulated it, whether it was Tampa or Phoenix or Houston to some extent, or Jacksonville or Charlotte or Nashville. Many cities, particularly in the South and Southwest, that were growing in the 60s, 70s, and onward, have used this model of going out and offering these big public expenditures as a way of wooing major professional sports. Beforehand, there had been cities that convinced teams to relocate before, but the idea of this grand political civic project that a city is going to go out of its way to try to become major league, Atlanta essentially invents that in the 1960s. And that's essentially how Atlanta is remade by pro sports, and also how Atlanta remakes pro sports by creating this model for how cities can get to the big leagues. And also this model for how cities often ended up being quite disappointed by the results that teams didn't just walk in and take control in these leagues. Oftentimes, they struggled for many years as a result of it. They didn't develop fan bases as quickly as they thought they would. And I think many, many successful businessmen have found that the sports business is a very specific and particular one. And just because you're good at selling insurance or real estate or have a successful factory doesn't mean you're going to be especially good at running a football team or a hockey franchise.
You can look no further than the team we always talk about on my show, the Detroit Lions, and the Fords officially taking over the day Kennedy got assassinated. I think it's been one playoff game victory, if I'm correct on that, since the Fords have taken over. So yeah, just because you're good at making cars doesn't mean you're good at a football team.
Well, they did beat the Cowboys, I believe, in that one playoff game. So they really went for it when they if you're going to bother to beat one, you're beating America's team. Pretty good in that respect, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Cowboys were falling all over themselves on that famous Barry Sanders run. I guess if we can put a fork in anything. But so, okay, you mentioned that the fan base didn't necessarily gain as much steam as they would have anticipated. Did any of it have to do, from your research, with there's four sports major league teams within 6 years? Is that a cannibalization factor going on?
Absolutely. Yes, that's one of the major themes of the book. If you're going to bring teams in, don't bring them all in so quickly, because there's only a certain amount, even in a city where there were a lot of wealthy suburban people in metropolitan Atlanta, there's only so many people who are going to choose to use their discretionary income that way. So all these teams are essentially fighting for the same consumers. And the honeymoon these teams enjoyed got smaller and smaller and smaller as these teams came in so rapidly. In addition, in a city like Atlanta, a lot of the people who lived in the suburbs, they didn't really want to come into the city. They didn't want to sit around and sweat it out in the stands. They wanted to go golfing. They wanted to go boating. So some of it's a matter of lifestyle. Some of it's a matter of just how profoundly suburban Atlanta is. Atlanta, the city, was roughly a city of 400 or 500,000 people in the 60s and 70s in a metro area that was growing to around 2 million. So that's only a small percentage of the potential. The city itself is only a small percentage of the region's population. Now the city of Atlanta is still roughly around 500,000, but in a metro area of 6 million people. So less than 10% of the people in the metropolitan area actually live within the physical confines of Atlanta. So this very spread out metropolitan area over like 20 counties. If you commute into the city for work, commute back home, the idea of going back in on a weeknight in particular to go to a game, that's only a select group of people who are going to want to do this. And I think particularly in the case of the Braves, that was very difficult for people expecting people in the summertime to just sweat it out like that. In terms of football, I think, and this speaks to a broader problem, people were huge football fans in Atlanta already. It was a football mad market. But the Falcons game for many people was only the third most important game of the weekend. You had your Friday night high school game. On Saturday, you had Georgia Tech or you had Georgia, or there were a range of very popular historically black college football teams in the city, too. The Falcons were an afterthought for many people. I mean, the Falcons drew pretty well in the early years just because it was football in Atlanta. Also, a lot of people went because they wanted to go see Vince Lombardi's Packers or go see Johnny Unitas play or go see Fran Tarkenton, who'd been a big star at the University of Georgia. The fans that going were not necessarily Falcons fans. They were fans who wanted to see football, wanted to see this attraction in town. And over time, as the Falcons struggled year after year, attendance became more of an issue, particularly the issue of no-shows. The NFL is very much built around selling season tickets, so the Falcons sold a lot of, compared to other sports, relatively inexpensive season tickets for 7-8 game packages, depending on the year. But toward the end of the season, as the Falcons fell out of contention, they dealt with a real problem of no-shows. Fans who have purchased a ticket to a game through a season ticket, but don't bother to attend. In the 1974 season, the Falcons, almost 4 in 10 of the people who bought a ticket to a game did not bother to attend. In their final two home games, they had more than 40,000 no-shows at both games in a 55,000-seat stadium. I mean, these stadiums were empty on these days. They were kind of like 40-ish degrees, a little rainy, a little unpleasant. The Falcons were out of contention. These stadiums were basically empty, even though almost all of the tickets were sold as a result of this phenomenon. And things looked really bad on television when you have 8 or 9,000 people at a game in a 55, 60,000-seat stadium.
Yeah, it's like a preseason game. I mean, I guess I didn't realize. So when was the, oh geez, that wasn't called the Superdome. What was the one before Mercedes-Benz called downtown?
Well, there was the Georgia Dome opened in 1991. Before that was Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. The action I'm talking about happens almost exclusively at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, which opened in 1965 to be the home for the Braves and then the Falcons. Building this stadium was essentially Atlanta's key to getting into major professional sports. The Georgia Dome followed it. The Falcons were basically never happy with their stadium deal. They were always second-class citizens to the Braves. The Braves were actually the main tenant with the city. Like 7.5% of every ticket the Falcons sold went into the Braves' coffer. So there was a degree of resentment about that. When the Falcons came out, they were coming out of the Braves' dugouts. They were in the Braves' lockers. So it never really felt like their stadium. Rankin Smith, who was the owner of the Falcons in 1978, builds them their own facility in Suwanee, Georgia, which is roughly 30 miles from the city. And that, in many ways, begins the process of the Falcons having a degree of independence from the Braves they didn't initially in the city. They have their own training facility. When the stadium lease comes up, they push for a new stadium, which gets approved, the Georgia Dome, which proved to be a very successful venue in many ways. It had the Super Bowl a couple of times. The Falcons were definitely better in the 90s and 2000s at the Georgia Dome than they've been for much of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And Mercedes-Benz has gone very well, too. It's a very nice, modern new stadium. So the Falcons struggled with their stadium situation initially. And they struggled ownership-wise, too. I mean, their first owner, Rankin Smith, was a very successful insurance salesman who basically got involved with pro football because his fraternity brother, the governor of Georgia, Carl Sanders, needed somebody to be the primary investor for an NFL bid. And he convinced his former frat brother at the University of Georgia to join up. And Rankin Smith did, and he was a very cordial and pleasant guy. People said he had a very nice family. He had a tendency to rely on his associates in the insurance business to play prominent roles in a football organization, and that proved to be a profound failure. In 1967, the Falcons had a draft where not a single guy they selected made the team. And this is an expansion team. This is a bad roster as it is. They were a 3-11 team, and then in year two, the guys they select, none of them end up on the actual team. They have a GM who's basically an insurance man their first couple of years. Eventually, the Falcons start to turn things over to more experienced people. But really, as long as the Smiths owned the organization, they had a lot of people in prominent positions who were not football experts.
Yeah, you keep hitting a lot of chords with me. Not a football person that's in charge of the operations and the Lions that comes to mind. Totally.
There's so many parallels. And I think people think the Fords, you know, they're pleasant to deal with. They're, you know, I think generally they're seen as being kind of benevolent, friendly owners, player friendly. The Smiths were the same way. It's just that they, you know, the Lions have had pleasant owners, but not a lot of on-field success for a very long time, just as the Falcons did for a generation under the Smiths.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, there are some parallels there. And going back earlier when you said that how the Falcons pretty much had to, they were the second-rate citizens, you know, against the Atlanta Braves. And we're talking a time when really probably right before we were in the middle of when the NFL was about to overtake Major League Baseball as America's pastime, probably about a decade later there. I mean, just I could not even imagine nowadays in most cities where the baseball team would be the first-rate citizen opposed to the NFL team.
Very much so. Yeah, that transition is certainly taking place right as this, you know, moving into the Super Bowl era, moving into the merger and everything. Atlanta, when it really pushes for pro sports, baseball was the focus because of it being the national pastime. Because I think also in part because college football was such a big deal, that was almost like a pro sport in people's mind, particularly Georgia Tech in that time period was such a big deal. If you looked at the obituary columns in Atlanta newspapers, people would mention if they were season ticket holders, and then people would go and bid to get the season tickets of somebody who had just died who was a Georgia Tech season ticket holder since the 20s. So that was just such a big deal in the city. I think baseball also was just seen as the most prestigious of the leagues at the time. And Atlanta, when it got pro sports, they had a mayor named Ivan Allen, who when he campaigned for mayor in 1961, ran on a platform that was partially called Major League City. This idea that we're going to become first rate in pro sports, just as we are in business, just as we are in having a symphony orchestra, just as we are in theater. It was just one of the amenities that a big city was supposed to have. He loved the idea of the name Atlanta appearing alongside Los Angeles and Chicago and New York and Philadelphia in the standings, that it was just like one of those cities. was his concept. And in his mind, Major League Baseball was the most prestigious of the leagues, in part because it's only, I mean, through, I guess it would be through 1961, there's only 16 Major League teams that exist in 11 cities. So it's a very small number of cities that had teams up until right before then. So, it's a period of transition that's going on.
So we got that transition, and you just like, so the fans kind of coming into NFL more in football and such. I mean, granted, not college football. You kind of covered the origin story, the Falcons ownership and everything, but how long did it take before they would be a team of any significance?
They make the playoffs for the first time in 1978. So it takes them 13 years to become a playoff team. They get a guy named Eddie LeBaron, who'd been a very good quarterback in the 50s, becomes their GM. They end up getting Steve Bartkowski, who was a very successful quarterback. And they have a pretty good run in the late 70s and early 80s. They make the playoffs a couple of times. They win the division. But up until then, things were pretty rough. They had a couple of years in the early 70s when they were on the verge of being okay. They actually had a winning season in the early 70s under Norm Van Brocklin. The Falcons' first coach was a guy named Norb Hecker, who was an assistant to Lombardi, who was there for basically 2.5 seasons and was overwhelmed by the job. He didn't really have a roster to compete, in part because of the ownership not necessarily recruiting the best players, and also in part because the expansion draft in 66 was so weak. The league let every team protect 35 of their 40 roster players. Plus, you have the AFL having all the other good players in the country. So the potential number of guys you could get on your team, you really were dealing with guys that nobody else wanted on that team to a great extent, other than a handful of the guys they drafted, most notably Tommy Novus, who became a standout linebacker for many, many years. So Norm Van Brocklin takes over in partway through the 68 season and is in charge through 74. And he looks like he's going to turn things around, but he never quite rights the ship to the extent that this is a winning football team.
So I didn't realize that Norm Van Brocklin was their coach at some point in time.
Oh, he was. He's a piece of work, certainly. I mean, choking reporters for disagreeing them, getting in fights with reporters all the time. Just, said insane things all the time to the press. Yeah, he was not terribly popular with his players. Yeah, Norm Van Brocklin was. He was a man who lived in the 70s, who was certainly not of the 70s, I would say. I think he still thought he was in the 1940s or something.
Yeah, I mean, you find that over and over. Every decade you get someone that's at the end of their career and they're just not quite in the right position. What about the entire career? We got the Atlanta Falcons, and it's easy to get kind of, I guess, lost in the most recent years. But if you had to give me a Mount Rushmore of the most memorable players in Atlanta Falcon history, who would you put up there?
Well, in terms of the early years, I'd put Tommy Novus. He was the first player selected by the Falcons. He was the number one pick of the 1966 NFL draft. He actually got he was also picked in the, I think, fourth in the AFL draft by the Oilers. He was a stud linebacker at the University of Texas. He was a two-time All-American. He won the Outland Trophy. He chooses the Falcons over the Oilers from his home state. And becomes a standout for a decade. He was named to the NFL's All 1960s team. He was an All Pro on 5 or 6 occasions. He was a great player on a lot of very bad teams. Very kind of a brooding character, but just a standout player for many, many years for the Falcons, and belongs in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The Falcons had Claude Humphrey, who I think also could be placed on this Mount Rushmore, inducted into the Hall of Fame a couple of years ago, who was a standout pass rusher and defensive end throughout much of the 1970s. But I think Tommy Novus belongs alongside him in the Hall of Fame, because those are the two real standouts of the franchise's early years. In terms of the Mount Rushmore beyond them, Michael Vick, I think, certainly has to be on it. He added this a degree of flash and popularity to the franchise, and is certainly one of the most exciting players in the history of the game. I would think possibly I would like to give 50% of one to Deion Sanders and 50% for Andre Rison for that primetime era team, which was a very exciting team. And I think also that Falcons team of the early 90s, the Glanville era Falcons of that time, were maybe the first pro football team that was very strongly associated with hip-hop culture. And I think it's in large part because of them. And the Falcons over time develop a much larger, at least in terms of their live audience, a much larger African-American fan base. I think the popularity of those players no doubt played some role in that. Also, as the team moved to the Georgia Dome, had a larger seating capacity, I think it was more inclusive in terms of who could also afford to go to the games. So I guess, let me backtrack a little. I guess I have Tommy Nobis, Dion / Risen, Michael Vick, and I think I would put Matt Ryan as the fourth guy. I mean, he's just been such a stalwart for the organization, an excellent representative of the team. Following the drama of the end of the Vick era, having such a stable guy who's been so successful for such a long time, I think he's also just been a fantastic force for continuity in this organization, which could have gone back to its chaos in the aftermath of Vick. Those would be the guys who would come to mind for me. Steve Bartkowski was a fantastic quarterback for them. There was a guy named Dave Hampton, who was a running back in the 70s, who's an interesting character. He's the guy, I don't know if you've heard about him, who went over 1,000 yards, then got tackled for a loss, and ended up under 1,000 yards for the season, and that happened to him twice. He finally got over 1,000 yards in one time, I think it was in 1975. He finally made it over the hump. He's certainly one of the best players of their early eras. The Falcons had some great offensive linemen, Jeff Van Note, Mike Ken, perennial All-Pros in the 70s and 80s. So the Falcons have had a number of good players over their history. I would say in the past 30 years, really since they moved from the Georgia Dome, the idea that they're a bad franchise, that's not really the case. I would say they're probably middle of the pack since then, that they have their up times and their down times. Previous to that, they were certainly on the losing end of things, though.
So you kind of mentioned a name there. We're going to, this little DeLorean, I don't know if you can see it in the screen.
Oh, I see it well.
You're going to be hopping in this DeLorean and go back in time. But actually, now we got to go forward about 3 or 4 weeks. Matt Ryan, is he going to get traded to a Super Bowl contender, you think?
Boy, I hope not. I think there's a lot to be said for the nobility of a guy playing an entire career in a place, and that their identity as a pro player is so firmly cemented in a particular community. This Stafford leave, I mean, I really have no association with the Lions, but I thought Stafford leaving after being there such a long time was an unfortunate thing. I like the idea of guys playing their entire career in one place, and I would love it if Matt Ryan did that. Chasing championships, I don't know. I guess I'm not as preoccupied with that as some people. I love the idea of guys being the representative of a particular place, and I think Matt Ryan has been that for this generation in Atlanta, and I hope he finishes his career there.
It might not be his choice. We'll see what happens as it goes forward and everything. And if there comes a team and knocking. Now, you seem to be very much in tune with the city. And even though you're not from there, did you find yourself? Okay, two questions. Did you grow up an NFL fan?
Yeah, I grew up. I grew up in Vermont. I grew up a New York Jets fan. I mean, Vermont's a funny place because they don't have a team specifically. Most people are now Patriots fans. That's really a product of the last 20 years. When I was a kid, most people were Giants fans, but it was also like the Lawrence Taylor, Phil Simms, Bill Parcells winning Super Bowl eras. So I think people here kind of go with the flow. The Giants also had their training camp in Vermont for quite a few years. They had their training camp at a small Catholic college called St. Michael's College for a big chunk of the 50s. And I think that also contributed to the Giants being the local team, also being on TV all the time. I became a Jets fan because my mom was a Jets fan. My mom loved Joe Namath. My mom was a Jets fan ever more after that. So I became a Jets fan, and my family is as a result of that.
Okay, so even though you're a Jets fan, you seem to have an affinity for the Falcons. Do you find yourself like that's your NFC team, no doubt, or is it just it's another team?
You know, I sort of have an affinity for all of the Atlanta teams now. Even the Calgary Flames, who moved from Atlanta, I also think they have a fantastic sweater, one of the best sweaters in the NHL. You know, the thing is, I feel like if you spend a lot of time researching a particular team, even if you didn't feel anything for them beforehand, you just know their history, you know what the fan base has been through, you know how they would respond to things. So yeah, I definitely feel an affection for the Falcons. Although, to be frank, I think the Saints have just about the best helmet in the NFL. I've always just loved the look of that helmet. That and the Chargers are probably my two favorite helmets. I want the Falcons to do well. I have, Game Pass. So if I don't watch the Falcons game live, I tend to go back and watch it because people will ask me questions about it. So I go back and watch all their games just so I'm informed about the team week to week too.
Yeah, because it's easy for us to think that you're an author for a book about professional sports in Atlanta, just to naturally think that's where you're from, which of course is not the case being from Vermont and almost as far as you can get away, just staying on the Eastern Seaboard. You only got one more state up there.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Vermont is about as unlike Atlanta as a place as I can think of, but it's very, very quiet kind of place. Atlanta's, very loud and, very loud and busy kind of place.
Now, okay, so going back to your back in time with your professor of U.S., is it just U.S. history in general, or is there a specific avenue?
I mean, in general, I teach a range of classes. My area of scholarly expertise is American cities post-World War II, but that's fairly specified. But yeah, I teach the full range of American history.
So growing into that profession, so when you went into Boston College, and like, did you know from an early age, I want to be a professor of U.S. history, and it intrigued you, or did you just stumble into it?
Well, I loved history from a very early age. I mean, my parents, for vacations, we'd go to like battlefields in Virginia. I loved the Civil War, loved the Ken Burns Civil War series. You know, I've been to Gettysburg and Fredericksburg and a lot of the different battlefields in Virginia and Pennsylvania and stuff. And I always loved the Civil War. When I got out of college, you know, I bounced around a little bit, and I'd been a double major in history and poli sci in college. And, I applied to a few graduate programs in history. The idea of sitting around reading about history and talking about it and getting paid for it, I found very appealing. And it all worked out. And I had a great graduate experience at Boston College and had a wonderful group of professors and as well as students that I taught too.
I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if I went into the wrong type of thing. You know, I just got I have an MBA, so it's just like a general business and a little bit of marketing. But I find myself in, so for instance, Hardcore History, Dan Carlin. Do you listen to that?
Oh, love it. Yes. And I love when you had him on. That was so awesome when you had him on the podcast.
That's right. Yeah. I did bring Dan on from 100th episode. That was like, even though nothing to do with football from what I understood going into it, but then you listen to the show. So he was way more of an NFL fan or football fan than I even realized. And he knew a ton about it.
It was a fantastic episode. Yeah, very knowledgeable guy.
So with that, going back to the history and everything, you know, I have a DeLorean question every time, and I showed you that DeLorean. Mm-hmm. Let's put you in that DeLorean for real. Let's go back in time. But because it's a football history podcast, let's focus on Atlanta Falcon history. And you can go from your research to any point in Atlanta Falcon history time, where you're going and to relive that moment.
I would want to go to week five in the 1966 season. It's their first season. The Falcons are hosting the Green Bay Packers. They have a sold out, full crowd at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. Excited to see the defending world champions. The Packers come in and absolutely eviscerate the Falcons. They win 56-3. Lombardi is coaching against his former assistant, Norb Hecker, who he, in fact, did not recommend the Falcons to hire, refused to give him a recommendation. After the game, he tells the press corps that this is not a tough team we played. He just couldn't have buried Hecker more and made him look worse to his hometown press. And what would have been interesting to me is sitting there in the second half in the stands watching all the people get up and leave. Because it's really the first time at a Falcons game that they have this issue of people leaving the games early. That halftime, it's like a 35-6 game, or it's 35-3 game, and people kind of gave up on it and they started to leave. And what are the people thinking about? They're thinking about that they had this, that they made these grand investment in this team, that they had hoped so much for this Falcons franchise. They come in, they're just getting absolutely clobbered. Do they see this as kind of a rebuke of all they've done, or is it simply a matter that they're bored of the game? I guess what is going through people's minds as they get up and leave the game, because in many ways that's kind of this story of the book. It's a story of a city with all these aspirations, and things don't quite live up to what they expected. And I think for at least in the case of the Falcons, that might be the first physical event when that idea had occurred to a lot of people. I mean, the Falcons had lost each of their first four games, but that they were just thoroughly uncompetitive. I'm curious what was going through those people's minds that afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, that brings me to back to my team. We have the Dan Campbell experience, and by the time this episode releases, who knows how many games we will have played, because I'm not sure what day this is going to release yet. But it's easy to get behind a guy like that. Yeah, sure, I want to bite kneecaps off and I don't have any turds here, but to how long can a professional organization really go down that path? And I'm one of them that understands this is a year where you get 5 wins, we're happy. You know, this is building for the future. And I'm curious, a team like that, like you said at the beginning of it, wow, we made this major investment. Or did we make the wrong decision? I mean, overall, so if you had to put a stamp on it, was it the right move?
For Atlanta to acquire a pro football team?
Correct.
I think almost inevitably they were going to at some point. I think it's kind of unfortunate they didn't get a team in the AFL because I think they would have been more competitive. They actually had the choice between the two. Both leagues were offering them a team for the 1966 season. Essentially, Atlanta saw the NFL as being more prestigious, so they took that. But then they end up within a couple of years, they're in the NFC West, and the team has to travel out to the coast all the time. The Falcons, for many years, traveled more than any team in the league. They're undermanned because from day one, the expansion draft was so weak in 66. All the other good players are also in the AFL. So they ended up very hamstrung as a result of being an NFL team as opposed to an AFL team. And I think it was worth it, but if, you know, using, I guess, hindsight being 2020, going in the AFL, I think would have been the way to go.
So, I mean, you, again, going back, you've kind of, this is like a decade in the making because of your paper from college. In the research process, I mean, interviews, what's the research process for this book?
I did about 50 interviews for the book. I interviewed some former players from all the teams. I interviewed some politicians. I think most significantly, I put a lot of effort into finding fans who'd experienced this, who'd followed Atlanta's teams over the course of these decades, so I could talk to them about how all of this felt. What did it feel like following a team that wasn't very good? How did they follow the team? What was the experience like of the team getting worse and worse and worse? What was the stadium like? What was the relationship between the fans and the players like? So getting a real sense of the fans' perspective on this was an important part of the book to me. And a lot of this is kind of snapshots, but I think in terms of telling an evocative story, getting the voices of the people who experienced it on the ground just as fans is an important thing. Because players are going to look at things a little bit differently. A political leader is going to look at things differently. Most people who experienced it were going to experience it more like those fans did. And to me, it was very important to give them a voice, which would have possibly otherwise not exist if I didn't go out and find them. I did about 50 interviews for the book. I spent a long time in different archives, spent many, many days in different archives in Atlanta, whether it was the Atlanta History Center or different universities there. I went to the Baseball and the Football Hall of Fame's research archives to get materials from them on the franchises. I spent months and months looking through newspapers, whether it was the Atlanta Constitution, the Atlanta Journal, which became the Journal Constitution collectively, which is the main paper now, the Atlanta Daily World, which was the city's primary black-oriented newspaper in the time period. I looked at newspapers from cities that had lost teams to Atlanta. So I looked at the St. Louis papers because the Hawks of the NBA had ended up there. And also the St. Louis Cardinals almost moved to Atlanta in 1965. The Bidwills, who still own the Cardinals franchise now, tried to leverage a better stadium deal in St. Louis by threatening to move their team to Atlanta. I looked at the papers from Milwaukee because the Braves came from Milwaukee. I looked at papers from Calgary, Alberta. So it was a mix of archives, a lot of newspaper work, and also interviewing people. And that process takes time. I mean, a lot of the people I interviewed back in like 2012 or 2013 or 2014. So these interviews are, you know, a few years old now.
So did you know back then that you were, I'm going to write a book?
Absolutely. Yes. I went to graduate school thinking it would give me the ability, the skills, and also the credentials to get a book published. Yeah, I've wanted to be an author since I was a kid. Not so much a professional historian, but I've always enjoyed writing. And at one point I wanted to write fiction more, but I've moved certainly in the nonfiction direction. And it's a fun creative outlet, and I also just enjoy the research too. So it's been an incredibly rewarding experience to both write the book and then see it through to this process with the University of Nebraska Press, who's been great to work with.
Yeah, I've had multiple authors on where that's where they were published as well. So they're heavy into sports history books, from what I gather.
Absolutely, yes, yeah. That's really their. I mean, they do a lot of things, but it's become one of their bread and butter places. And it's Rob Taylor and the whole crew there has been great to work with.
All right, so you can pick one of those stories and pluck them out, and you can kind of give me the cliff notes of one of the stories from your interviews. Which one are you going to ride or die with?
I think just talking to people about going to Atlanta Fulton County Stadium and seeing how quickly this brand new stadium ended up becoming kind of grubby and falling apart, and stories of rodents in bathrooms and in the concession stands and all this kind of stuff. That Atlanta Fulton County Stadium was built in 51 weeks. Most stadiums take 2 years, 3 years, 4 years to build. They had a contract to bring the Braves there, and they were going to make it happen. So they built the stadium as quickly as possible, and it showed. Within a decade of the stadium opening, it was basically falling apart, and they kind of patched it together through the mid-90s when it was replaced first by the Georgia Dome for the Falcons, and then was replaced for the Braves by the Olympic Stadium, which became Turner Field. So in many ways, just the stories of the craziness of Atlanta Fulton County Stadium are what stick out to me from the fans I spoke with in particular.
Yeah, I mean, again, going back, this is cool how you spent so many years writing this book. And like you said, you just knew you wanted to write a book. If anyone is interested in getting this book, how would they get their grubby hands on it?
Well, Loserville, How Professional Sports Remade Atlanta and How Atlanta Remade Professional Sports is being published by the University of Nebraska Press. It's available for pre-order now through Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and all of the well-known online book retailers. It physically becomes available on February 1st. Up until then, love for you to pre-order it. I'd love for you to check me out on Twitter at Clayton Truter, CLAYTONTRUTOR. I'm on Facebook, too. I'd love to be your friend there. And those are the main ways to get in contact with me, and I hope everybody enjoys the book.
Perfect. And give me some last words of gridiron knowledge nuggets or wisdom for the listener of the show.
William Clay Ford paid, I believe, $5 million for the Lions in 1963. 20 years later, when Alex Spanos purchases the Chargers, he pays $80 million for the team. The value of a pro football team increases like 15-fold in 20 years. That is the story of the expansion of pro football in terms of its popularity and financial value on the North American continent.
There you go. Now, the book is not out yet, so you can't get your grubby little hands on it right now. But what you can do is you go ahead and pre-order at most of your favorite bookstores. I just went on to Barnes & Noble's website. I clicked in Clayton Truter, Loserville. Bam, right there. Pre-order. Nebraska University, where he's going to have it, right at the Nebraska University Press. Go on their website. Bam. Pre-order right there. And again, don't forget to check out this week's sponsor, Row One Sports. You can sign up for the t-shirt giveaway and then also get on that 15% discount code. There may or may not be a certain time of year coming up where you might or might not want to get some gift to your sports history loving friend, or maybe even some kind of family member that might have been at a game that they recall from the 1960s or something. You know, I'm just saying, there might be some mugs, t-shirts, cool art for the wall, all sorts of things. I'm just saying, go check it out. SportsHistoryNetwork.com/row1. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.